On this episode of Skeptico, Steve Volk discusses ghosts with parapsychology investigator and author Guy Leon Playfair.
What's your best guess at this stage, after all these years, on what poltergeists are?
Well, I mean, the short answer is that there are two possibilities. You know, either they are some kind of discarnate entity, which I certainly don't rule out, or else they are entirely unknown force that emanates from human minds. How it works, we simply don't know. We can only observe its effects. I think there's quite strong evidence for some kind of so-called spirit or discarnate entity, kind of drifting blobs of ex-intelligences, if you like. But that is an extremely controversial opinion, and not many people share it.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, Steve Volk brings us a very interesting interview with Guy Leon Playfair. Here's Steve's interview.
All right, I'm Steve Volk, guest hosting for Alex Sakaris on Skeptico, and my guest today is Guy Leon Playfair, a journalist and translator who has been conducting paranormal research seemingly forever. His first book, The Unknown Power, a book on psychical research, was written in 1975. In the ensuing years, he has written about Uri Geller, hypnotism, telepathy among twins, reincarnation, and we'll discuss some of those things. But today we're going to focus out of the gate on the topic of Guy's new book, a re-release, really, of a book first published in 1980. The book is called This House is Haunted, and it deals with a very famous Enfield poltergeist case. I wanted to talk to Guy because in my book, Fringeology, I kind of out myself describing what I call the family ghost, an old ghost story I grew up with as a child. I was about 6 years old and have a few memories of the events my family has described to me. But in general, without getting into too much detail, there was a booming and thumping sound that came from the walls and ceiling, and it seemed to respond to my parents' movements in the house. My sisters talked about having the blankets pulled from them as they slept there, beds shaking in unison in the middle of the night, and a female apparition who walked through the room. I'm hoping Guy, in talking about the Enfield case, can give me a little insight into poltergeists, including some details on a new study which used some recordings from the Enfield case, conducted by a Dr. Barry Colvin, with whom Guy cooperated. And hopefully we will get to much else besides. Guy, thanks for being on Skeptico.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Please, can you describe, for starters, how you got involved in the Enfield case and just sort of the basic outline of it?
Well, it was a string of very strange coincidences. I had intended to go on holiday in August of 1975 when I had just returned from Brazil. 77. And I happened to go to the Society for Psychical Research monthly lecture, which happened to be on poltergeists. And I happened to sit in the next row to a fellow called Maurice Gross, whom I hardly knew. And at the end of the talk, which was very well done, Maurice jumped up and said he was working on a case right now, which looked very interesting. And he'd already been there for 2 or 3 days, and he wanted some help. Was anybody interested? Well, I wasn't. I wanted to go on holiday. I just finished a very long, difficult book, and I was pretty well worn out. Then 3 days later, I heard him on the radio on BBC lunchtime news program. It made the main news. The BBC had sent along a reporter who'd managed to record all kinds of live action. And I thought, hell, this is serious, and the holiday will just have to wait. So I joined Maurice the next day and stayed with the case for 14 months. It was a long time without a holiday, but it was worth it.
Yeah, could you talk to me a little bit about what kind of phenomenon you encountered?
Well, just about everything you've ever heard of. I mean, we didn't have any green slime running down the wall. We had everything else. And it started with objects being flung around, which I was able to witness. small things like marbles and pieces of Lego brick. And later on, the big stuff started. I mean, I saw a heavy armchair sliding along the floor and going over backwards when nobody was anywhere near it. We had the big sofa in the main room flip over on its face, which is almost impossible for one person to do. You need one at each end. And, it just went on and on. I mean, you name it, and we had it.
Was there a particular moment you can isolate for me when you thought something strange really is going on here? Some initial
occurrence? Yeah, the first day I was there, I thought something strange was going on. Because, I mean, to start with, what the skeptics tend to forget is that the atmosphere in that house, to start with, they were all absolutely scared out of their wits. They wouldn't sleep without the light staying on all night. And eventually, all the two girls and the mother were sleeping in the same bed. They were absolutely terrified. The idea that one of them was sort of playing tricks just to amuse the others and kept it up for 14 months is just totally stupid.
What was the thing that got you?
The very first incident, I think, was quite a minor one. I was outside the bedroom late at night when the girls were in bed, hopefully asleep, and something hit the floor, and I found it was a marble, and it just gave a single bang. It didn't bounce, and it didn't roll, and we tried to repeat that, and we just couldn't. If you drop a marble, it will not keep still. It'll either bounce, it's a light, fairly light one, and this one did bounce. And the one I heard, just as if somebody had picked it up and put it on the floor by hand, as it were, slammed it down so it didn't move. And this happened several times. It was other people observed the same thing. And then I think it was that night with a book that was on the mantelpiece came out of the room and went round a corner. I actually saw that. It shot out of the back bedroom and ended up in the hall, having made a turn of about 60 degrees, which is rather hard to explain by normal aerodynamics. And it went on and on. I mean, I think I made a list of about 30 incidents that I'd witnessed close up under perfect conditions, and it was obvious right from the start that this was a proper case and an unusually intense one.
Well, let's address this question of fraud head on. For instance, in the marble scenario, Guy, do you know at that point where in the house the girls were?
They were in bed, right in front of me. I mean, I was standing outside the bedroom door, which was open, and I could see the foot of the bed, and I could see perfectly well if anybody had got out, and they were in there snoring away, and this marble just slammed onto the floor quite close to me.
And where was Mom?
She was downstairs, I think. She wasn't around.
Yeah. See, I bring this up, this case is so fraught. So many, claims and counterclaims over the years, and you were one of the people, though, who was there. I know that witnesses to various episodes included yourself, neighbors, the police, but the skeptics have, to their own satisfaction at least, claimed to explain all this away. And I want to get into this. Other researchers from the Society for Psychical Research came to investigate. But when they came into one of the girls' rooms, namely Janet, right? These are the Hodgson family. Yeah, the girls asked them to stand facing away, and then they were hit with objects while the children giggled. The investigators felt that the children, there were some odd voices, maybe we can get into those too. Investigators felt that the children were producing the voices themselves and trying to hide it by burying their faces in sheets. And there was one researcher, Anita Gregory, who claimed that the children's uncle had told her he believed Janet had taught herself to talk in this deep voice and that she'd always been athletic and mischievous and delighted in tricking strangers. He apparently believed that Janet was the cause of the phenomenon. I just want to give you a chance to sort of unpack
that. The uncle certainly never said any of that to me. I got exactly the opposite impression. He witnessed a great deal of extraordinary stuff himself, And he also saw a fully materialized apparition, which he described in great detail. He was very much attached to the two girls. They were very fond of him. And he was in the house almost constantly. He never gave the slightest indication to us that there was any sort of trickery. Well, there was trickery by December, which is when that incident took place, because the girls were getting back to normal, and 12-year-old girls tend to play tricks. I mean, I'd be quite worried if they hadn't. It showed they were getting over it. But the thing was, they were not very good at it. I mean, they on one occasion they hid my tape recorder and said that the ghost had taken it away, and so I said, oh yeah, and I found it quite soon, and it was still running, having recorded all the evidence. And I just said, look, okay, please don't mess around with my tape recorder. And so they knew that we knew that they'd played one or two tricks, which they've always admitted they were always caught. They said that over and over again. We did play one or two tricks just to see if Mr. Gross and Mr. Playfair would catch us, and they always did. So I hope that coin has dropped finally.
Yeah, I don't think it will be, though.
They never give up, these skeptics. You know, they just won't admit defeat ever, whatever I say.
Well, you're getting to something interesting here to me, because when I even read the claims and counterclaims back and forth, right, as a journalist, I find myself in a sort of, let's say, a netherworld, right? And what I mean by that is this seems unexplained. Doesn't mean that necessarily, right, that poltergeist exists and that there are spirits in the world. It doesn't mean that it was or wasn't fraud. It just means that when I read over the material I've read over, I can't really say with certainty what happened.
Well, there's one point that skeptics seem to overlook, is that by any kind of law of probability, you will not get witnesses from all over the world who've had absolutely no contact with each other, and many of whom have never read a single word about poltergeists. In fact, at Enfield, they didn't even know they'd never heard the word before. They always used to refer to it as poltergeist. You would not get them all saying exactly the same thing, describing identical incidents, whether it's in Brazil or South Africa or Iceland or Australia or wherever. It just would not happen. You know, if they were trying to fake a case, they've got to know what the real stuff is. As I think it was William James was the first to point out that you can't invent a new trick unless you can't produce any fake something unless there is a genuine something. And that's quite a good point, I think. You don't know where to start.
How did this affect the family, from your perspective, over the years?
Well, it did upset them a great deal. The eldest daughter, I'm more or less in touch with now and then. She's still afraid that it's going to all start up again, and I keep telling her that it's just no way that that's not going to happen. And I've lost touch with the younger girl who's married and moved out somewhere. And it did make a lasting impression on them. And an interesting point is that Janet, the eldest girl, she was twice offered a huge sum of money to confess by two of our popular newspapers. And she just told both of them to bleep off. You know, no way. I mean, she could have made enough money to practically buy a house. I mean, it was a big bribe. And it didn't work.
What's your best guess at this stage, after all these years, on what poltergeists are?
Well, I mean, the short answer is that there are two possibilities. You know, either they are some kind of discarnate entity, which I certainly don't rule out, or else they are an entirely unknown force that emanates from human minds. How it works, we simply don't know. We can only observe its effects. I think there's quite strong evidence for some kind of so-called spirit or discarnate entity, kind of drifting blobs of ex-intelligences, if you like. But that is an extremely controversial opinion, and not many people share it. So perhaps I better keep quiet about it for the time being.
Do you know if Dr. Colvin has a position here, or do you want to stay away from characterizing it?
Well, I can't put words in his mouth. He's a very articulate fellow, and he's a good scientist. He's very cautious, and I doubt if he shares my eccentric opinions. But I think I should really wait until he gets into print, which I hope he will, in due course. If we get any serious rebuttals of his paper, I'm sure the journal will print them. They're not afraid of them.
Well, I'm hoping the folks at Rational Skepticism will, in fact, submit their work for publication, and I'd love to see Dr. Colvin. And I understand he's busy, but you know, stick his head above ground a bit, and you know, maybe come on Skeptico and talk about his research and their research, and you know, just where from his perspective it all falls out.
Yeah, well, I hope they do that.
I have to say, for myself, I find the family ghost story I mentioned at the top, right, in my history, to be the kind of episode that forces me to accept a certain amount of cognitive dissonance as my best option, right? So I believe my family, and I'm not going to go over all the details of the story here, I believe my family, but I have a really hard time as the years have passed believing the story, because it doesn't fit neatly into my own store of experiences. And I've just sort of settled on the idea for now that there are some things that simply remain unexplained. And I'm curious, what would your advice be for me, given all the time you've had in the trenches of all this?
Well, from the brief description you gave of your case, I can only say that it's extremely similar to what you might call the typical case, particularly the bedclothes interference. That's very common, beds shaking. We had that practically every night at Enfield. And apparitions are much rarer, but they do happen, and we had at least two at Enfield. So at a guess, I would say your case was genuine, and if it didn't recur, then there's nothing to worry about. I'm sure it won't bother you now.
No, and in fact, what I'm struggling with, I shouldn't even say struggling with, because I'm no longer struggling with it, but what I was concerned with is just, where do I file it, right? Like, what do I do with it? What is it, what should it sort of make me think or not think in terms of my outlook on the world? I mean, that was what I, coming up as a kid anyway, that was what I had to sort out for myself. And in part, that's what the book deals with. But I'm just sort of curious, you know, for you, where you file these experiences.
Well, I file everything in my filing cabinet. I mean, I would put that down under personal or something. And I think what makes it interesting is if you read as much as you can in the area and find similar experiences that happened to other people. And we've no idea what poltergeists are. It's just a word that we use for something we don't understand. And it's probably a very misleading one, too. But we're stuck with it, and we don't have another one.
I will say, I do find it interesting that in some cases, skeptics have started putting forth more complicated and, I would say, interesting and probably fruitful theories than the usual, the mind plays tricks, wishful thinking, creaking floorboards, leaky pipes kind of explanations. So here I'm talking about the kind of thing that was published in the Journal of Neuroquantology, I believe, about potential effects coming from the minds of living human beings. Michael Persinger, and the idea of EMF waves somehow being involved, or Vic Tandy and infrasound. These are all things that, while essentially materialistic, they at least speak to the idea that something odd and dramatic happened, as opposed to someone heard a floorboard creak and then their imagination took over, which I've always found just, you know, plainly, yes, that happens in some instances, but it's certainly no blanket explanation.
No, there's another possible line of inquiry that poltergeist outbreaks have got certain features in common with Tourette syndrome, you know, where you get these sort of jerks and muscular spasms and things, and also very strange vocal sounds. And a poltergeist looks rather like an extension, a sort of super Tourette, where not only the muscles twitch, but the furniture starts twitching as well. That's not my idea. That was actually Persinger and William Gall, who's a very experienced researcher. And I think it's an interesting line to follow up. And the psychiatrist, Jan Ehrenwald, who is a very highly respected researcher, he once told me personally at a lunch we had together that psychokinesis follows what he called established psychiatric principles. I mean, you get things like this voice is the mirror image of hysterical dumbness, and clairvoyance is a kind of mirror image of hysterical blindness, and telepathy was again sort of a reaction against mutism. So it's not, they're not totally beyond the grounds of any possible explanation, but we just don't really have a very neat explanation yet.
Look, I'd be remiss having you on here if I didn't explore at least a couple more topics with you in the time we have. We obviously don't have time to go through the whole Uri Geller experience,
like that.
But that could be several programs, right? But what's your take on him? I met a lot of people in the parapsychological community in researching this who believe Geller has some sort of ability but jumbles it up with a flair for theater and for magic tricks. What's your take?
Well, he's undoubtedly got genuine abilities. I have far too much experience of that. I mean, I've witnessed some really extremely strange incidents. I've seen an object appearing in midair in his house, which I don't see any possibility of any form of trickery on that. And he's done some very remarkable feats of telepathy. And he also repaired a clock of mine at long distance, and that's another program. So, I've got no doubt at all that Uri's got abilities, and he's also a great sort of, not quite a practical joker, but he really enjoys winding people up. And, he loves being controversial, he's told me that. And in fact, I seem to remember once I offered to set up a completely foolproof experiment, and he turned it down straight off. He said, oh no, I want to keep people guessing. And I think he's got a point there.
Yeah, he told me that the controversy ultimately has been very, very, very good for his career, that the night of the great Carson debunking was actually the best thing that ever happened to him.
Yeah, well, he loves being controversial, and I think he, I have a sort of theory that he actually encourages it. You know, he likes people to think he's a magician or faking or something, and then he'll suddenly do something that pulls you up short. And he's still going strong. I think he's in Ukraine right now doing a TV show. And he goes down very well. He's a terrific public speaker, really puts on a wonderful talk. And people just love it. You know, he's still going very strong, age of 60-something. And I think he's got a lot more mileage in him to come.
Look, you've talked about, before the interview, you and I had exchanged some emails, and you had mentioned that you wanted some time to talk about your research into twin telepathy.
Yes.
And, so what was your work there, and what did you find?
Well, that's another whole program. It's this is an example of one of those things where I tried to find a book about it back in the 1970s, when we had a very high-profile murder of a twin here in England. The editor of the Guinness Book of Records, Ross McWhirter, was shot dead by an IRA terrorist. And I thought, wondered if there's any truth in all this twin telepathy stuff. And I managed to get through to his brother through a friend who worked for him. And after a decent interval, he made tactful inquiries that, you know, did you feel anything when your brother was shot? And he said no. So I thought, well, that's that, and I forgot about it. Well, then, by another series of coincidences, which I always seem to attract, I got offered a book job in about 1996, I think it was, 20 years later. And the publisher happened to be the son of Norris McWhirter, the brother of the man who was murdered. And I happened to show him the article that I'd written for the SPR Journal. And Alistair, the son, took a look at an episode that I'd quoted from the novel by Alexandre Dumas, the Corsican brothers, where you have an incident where a brother is killed in a duel in Paris, and the other one is riding a horseback in Corsica, and he falls to the ground saying, "Mon Dieu, my brother has been killed." And indeed he had. So I showed that to Alistair, and he immediately said, "That's exactly what my father did." So I thought, eh? well, to cut a very long story short, he kindly gave me a statement, which I dictated. I wrote it down word by word on the spot. And yes, his father had reacted at the time of the shooting, and he'd completely wiped it from his memory. I think it's what they call fugue. You know, he just completely exterminated the memory of something so profoundly shocking as the sudden death of the twin, which is a very intensely close relationship. And until he died recently, he just did not remember it at all. But the son, who was there, saw it happen. So I thought this has to be looked into, and I did that. And come up with
wait, can we back up for a second? I'm sorry, Guy. The son saw the father react. The father just never remembered reacting to
it. Yeah, that's right. Well, he actually clutched his chest and slumped into an armchair. And the son was so alarmed, he ran for his mother to call an ambulance. And she was just about to do that when the phone rang, and it was the police saying that Ross had just been shot and they had to come and identify the body. So that's what happened. Yes, I thought this should be followed up, and then I started looking around and couldn't find any books about it. So as usual, I thought, well, somebody's got to do it, so I did it myself. And collected a huge amount of material and at last have persuaded a major university twin unit here in London is taking the subject seriously for the first time ever and doing a very large-scale survey. They've got 5,000 twins on their books, and I'm collaborating with a colleague of mine who's interviewing them and questioning them and so on, and establishing it that it's a very real phenomenon. They do experience telepathy, period. No doubt at all.
Can you tell me, so this is just a kind of a questionnaire. You ask them questions about whether or not they've had these sort of shared states.
Well, we've done two questionnaires. The first one a few years ago was a very informal one done at a garden party where we had a sort of telepathy tent, if you like, where they were just invited to come in and do simple tests, you know, the sort of getting card business. And we found that some of them were extremely good at it, and others were absolutely hopeless. And we found that, as George Orwell might well have said, that some identical twins are a lot more identical than others. That is literally true. Some of them never have an experience of telepathy at all and are even quite hostile about the very idea, and others have it all the time. I tried to figure out why should this be so, because they are genetically just about identical and brought up usually together, and what could the difference be? And the only difference that I can see is the timing of the actual splitting of the egg. It can be anywhere between day 1 and day 12. And if you split early on, each egg gets its own little individual plastic bag, what do you call it, a chorionic sac. And if the split is late, the embryos are literally entangled throughout pregnancy. And it seems to be logical that they are more likely to be in closer rapport than the ones who are individually wrapped. And they have done research in the University of Indiana into this kind of personality differences. They don't do any telepathy there, but they do find that the later the split, the closer the twins are sort of psychologically. So that's an interesting finding, and I hope that's continuing. And my guess is that that's got something to do with why there is such a huge difference between twins' experience of telepathy, ranging from kind of 100% down to zero.
You know, it's remarkable because we do seem to have this capacity to be connected. And I don't even, for myself, I don't even know to what degree we need to define it at the moment. You know, I can't, you know, as material or immaterial or whatever. I mean, I don't think we can get a final answer on that at this point anyway. So maybe the best solution in some instances is to just sort of stand back and enjoy it. And I read an article yesterday, I don't know if you're familiar with this, an experiment done with firewalkers in which they had not only the people walking on the coals, but the people observing them walking on the coals hooked to heart rate monitors. And the hearts of the people close to whoever was firewalking at the time, the firewalker themselves, and also people who had someone else there who was going to be firewalking, not everyone did, their hearts, as they put it, the researchers, beat as one. So their heart rates increased and decreased at the same rates, at the same times. And I'm not even going to make any claim for anything remotely paranormal going on there. But there is this degree to which we are connected and feed off each other, even if you just want to talk about mirror neurons and our capacity for empathy, that's really striking. And I do wonder where the connections between all these things might be.
Well, we've done, there have been experiments done in public here in London by a very well-known researcher, the late Maxwell Cade, who invented a machine called the mind mirror, where you can actually watch your own brainwaves flickering away. And he put on a show at one of these sort of psychic fair things where he had a healer and a patient both hooked up to mind mirrors. And after a period, you can see that the two brains are absolutely synchronized, which takes us right back to the early days of mesmerism, you know, where people like the Marquis de Puységur discovered that he could literally enter the mind of his patient and sort of do his thinking for him. And this has been swept under the rug for 200 years, and it's coming out again gradually with all this kind of quantum approach to things. Talking about non-local entanglement and all that stuff. And it does appear that you can actually blend your own brain, consciousness, whatever, with somebody else's. And now you can actually see it happen on an instrument.
Guy, I'm afraid all we've proven here is that you're a great radio guest or a podcast guest, because there's so many different topics that we could go on about for 40, 45 minutes. And whether it's with me or with Alex, I hope you'll come back.
Well, I'd love to. Yes, there's certainly a lot more to say about everything, but then there always is.
Thanks very much again, Guyline Playfair, for being on Skeptico, and I hope to see you back here again someday.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Thanks to Steve and Guy for that interview. If you'd like more information about this show or any of our previous shows, please visit the Skeptico website. It's at skeptiko.com. You'll find links to all our previous shows, over 100 of them, a link to our forum, a Facebook, link to me, and a place where you can just leave a comment about the show and chat with other people about it. Have several interesting shows coming up in the near future, some stuff I think you're really going to enjoy. Stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care. Bye for now.